Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st Century Perspective on the greatest rock albums in history.
Guitar up.
One, turn two, three.
I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the rise of progressive rock. But I fear tomorrow I'll be crying. Yes, I fear tomorrow I'll be crying. Yes, I fear tomorrow I'll be crying.
20%
First show in America up in Vermont, and we were booked at a college to play. All the kids there had taken this acid, you know, so they were all very glazed eyes, you know. So we turned up and said, it's the group, you know, it's King Crimson. Oh, fine, set your gear up here. They didn't know who we were. And what had happened was they thought they'd booked King Curtis. Instead, they got King Crimson, but they were so out of it, they didn't know the difference until we started. And we opened up with Mars, the God of War, with strobe lights, and people were having heart attacks, you know.
In the court of the Crimson.
Hi, this is Greg Lake, in the studio for the In the Court of the Crimson King, by King Crimson.
Writing on AllMusic.com, Bruce Etter is emphatic with the assertion that one of the most daring debut albums ever recorded by anybody is the debut In the Court of the Crimson King by the progressive rock band King Crimson, led by guitar mellotron virtuoso Robert Fripp. During its first 5 years of existence, King Crimson stretched both the language and the structure of rock into the realms of jazz and classical music, all the while avoiding pop and psychedelic sensibilities, end quote. Now, you can debate whether Robert Fripp has been as influential in challenging the boundaries of rock and roll as Charlie Parker or Miles Davis or Wynton Marsalis have been to jazz. But on this next point, there can be no argument. King Crimson has been a launching pad, and for at least one musician, drummer Bill Bruford, a landing pad for literally scores of the best players, including John Wetton of Asia, Boz Burrell of Bad Company, Ian McDonald of Foreigner, Bill Bruford of Yes, Greg Lake, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Tony Levin, Peter Gabriel, and Adrian Belew. All the while, Robert Fripp has been the sole common denominator across all 62. That's right. 62 King Crimson releases, not including best of compilations. That's mind-boggling. Robert Fripp is the Woody Allen of King Crimson, writing, performing, as well as directing the best talents. And I might add, like Woody Allen, Robert Fripp loathes doing interviews. So for this story of how King Crimson's debut album, In the Court of the Crimson King, was made in London, we went in the studio with King Crimson singer and bass player then, Greg Lake.
Well, how it happened was that Bob Fripp had formed a very strange group called Giles, Giles and Fripp with Mike Giles and his brother Pete. And they were a zany operation. I mean, they were really weird. They specialised in weird, you know. And they were on this record label called Decca. And Decca, you know, they were so weird that Decca really were going to drop them because they just, yeah, they were not in any way marketable, or they were just crazy, you know, it's crazy stuff. And I think Decca said to Bob, you know, look, you've really got to get a singer and you've got to start making some music which is more accessible and, you know, generally better, really, I think. So at the time, anyway, I was, and since I was very young, I was a guitar player, playing guitar. In fact, Bob and I went to the same guitar teacher, played guitar together for a lot of years. And Bob used to, when I was in bands when I was much younger, Bob used to come around and sit and watch the band, you know, and at the time he was at college doing something. So Bob and I had this long history of guitar playing, basically, is how it happened. He called me up one day and he said, look, you know, the thing is, we've got this record contract with Decca, but we've got to get a singer in the band and, you know, we've just got to get it happening a bit more. And he said, the only problem is that, he said, we can't have two guitar players and no bass. He said, could you play the bass? So at the time, I was doing nothing. So I said, well, yeah, okay, I'll play the bass. I'd never played the bass before, but I thought, well, how hard can it be? You know, in six strings, four strings, you work it out, you know.
Only two-thirds.
Yeah, so that seemed like a good idea. Ian McDonald came in. He was brought in on... He played a lot of things, Ian. He had flute. Fantastic flautist, Ian McDonald. But he was a multi-instrumentalist. He played sax, keyboards. And that's how the thing really started. So we met up, played, and that's how the band began.
Shattered by the sun, I walk a road, horizons change, the tournament's begun. The purple piper plays his tune, the choir softly sing three lullabies in an ancient tongue for the court of the crimson. Shutters on the dreams. I wait outside the pilgrim's door with insufficient schemes. The Black Queen chants the funeral march. The cracked brass bells will ring to summon back the fire witch to the court of the crimson. Thank you. To grasp divining signs to satisfy the hoax. The yellow jester does not play, but gently pulls the strings. Smiles as the puppets dance in the court of the crimson.
Went through some very strange early days. I mean, the sort of principle of the band started off with more or less free-form music, you know, where people would never play the same thing twice. On many occasions, there wasn't even a key established, you know. Nobody really related very much to keys, you know, like you could sort of choose your own key, really. And sort of accidents where people arrived in the same key were sort of almost frowned upon, you know. It was a strange sort of... But eventually it led up, this peculiar approach to music led up to a very unusual blend of sort of musical anarchy with myself and Ian McDonald supplying the melody and the emotion to the situation. So you had this sort of strange mixture of recklessness and anarchy and avant-garde ideas combined with emotion and melody and songs.
Crimson, with the title song from their October 1969 release, In the Court of the Crimson King, with Greg Lake on vocal, and featuring the distinctive, majestic sound of a precursor to the synthesizer called a Mellotron. Only the Moody Blues had introduced it by then to popular music, and their producer was picked to oversee this new group, King Crimson's first recordings, but the efforts were scrapped. King Crimson singer-bass player Greg Lake's account of the young band was unstructured and unpredictable, yet the album, In the Court of the Crimson King, has a sophistication that set a benchmark for what would later be termed progressive rock. I asked Greg Lake to explain.
But there was in the end. There was in the end. I mean, it was a discipline that I suppose I brought to it, really. I mean, Bob left to his own devices. The record wouldn't have been at all tangible. And I think the other thing is that bringing in the element of a singer naturally brings about songs, and songs naturally bring about organisation. And so there was a natural discipline which took over, which was that there had to be keys established and there had to be parts for people to play. But I can tell you that it was outrageous at times. And it would be outrageous live. You know, you'd come to play a live concert, and all of a sudden, where the chorus was supposed to be, the drums would stop, you know, and somebody'd start playing something entirely different without warning, you know. So everyone lived on their nerves in that band all the time, because it was instantaneous, without warning, and the policy was be ready for anything. I mean, don't miss anything, ever. So if someone shifted key, you were supposed to have sensed that in some sort of way. This happened all the time. I mean, it was a constant battle, really, to keep anything in an orderly way. I mean, if you looked around for a second, something else would be happening, you know? I mean, that was one of the beautiful things about the group, is that it was very alive and very inventive and creative. And the difficulty was to capture the good, strong moments and to make sure that they were repeated on record and to make sure that we could play them live. The inclination was always to move on.
Said the straight man to the late man, where have you been? I've been here and I've been there and I've been. I talk to the wind. My words are all carried away. I talk to the wind. The wind does not hear. The wind cannot hear. I'm on the outside. The wind does not hear. the straight man to the late man. Where have you been? I've been here and I've been there.
The lilting lyrical flute of Ian McDonald and vocal by Greg Lake. That's I Talk to the Wind by King Crimson. When we return, Greg Lake recounts King Crimson's first concert in America, plus the world's first grunge rock song. Download new expanded In the Studio shows for your iPhone or iPad, such as AC/DC. Download In the Studio now from the iTunes App Store. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Greg Lake for the King Crimson's In the Court of the Crimson King. King Crimson's original lead singer and bass guitarist Greg Lake died in December 2016. Greg was a great friend of In the Studio.
Hi, this is Greg Lake in the studio for the In the Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson.
Thanks, Greg. I'm Redbeard, marking this landmark release in the history of progressive rock and certainly one of the strongest debut albums anywhere. Singer-bass player Greg Lake picks up the King Crimson story in the fall of 1969.
It started off as a band to make a record. Yeah, it started off like that. And I think I'm right in saying that we never played shows before the record was made. Not to my recollection. We rehearsed and rehearsed and then made this record and then started to tour. I'll never forget the first show in America was in a place called Vermont, up in Vermont. And we were booked at a college to play. And we arrived at this college and all the kids there had taken this acid, you know. So they were all very glazed eyes, you know. So we turned up and said, it's the group, you know, it's King Crimson. Oh, fine. Set your gear up here. They didn't know who we were. And what had happened was they thought they'd booked King Curtis. Instead, they got King Crimson, but they were so out of it, they didn't know the difference until we started. And we start in those days, we had these strobe lights, right? And we opened up with Mars, the God of War, with strobe lights, and people were having heart attacks, you know. They sat down and thought they were going to get King Curtis, and what they got was Mars, the God of War, with strobe lights, you know.
Percent.
Ripped open a few skulls and blew up more than one Advent speaker in thousands of dorm rooms from the album In the Court of the Crimson King. That's 21st Century Schizoid Man. Pure fantasy then, of course. Here we are in the 21st century asking Greg Lake, who did that unforgettable vocal performance?
I think it was just overdriven through a channel, basically.
Is that you?
That's me, yeah. It was overdriven through a channel. It was just popped into distortion. I mean, real distortion, not controlled distortion, just absolute bored distortion. Bob had come up with this, I think he'd actually come up with the solo, you know, this business. And so he thought that would make a good song, you know. Bob, the thing is, you know, that it's going to be a bit hard getting a melody to work with this, you know. So after a while, We managed to so I don't know who came up. We managed to come up with a bam ba ba bam bam bam. Then it was the vocal, and then I wrote the vocal part in there. Pete did the lyrics for it, and that's how it happened. And then Giles got involved with the articulation on the drumming and everything. And that's how that thing built up, really. Yeah, that was another thing about the band too. I mean, it was extremely colourful texturally. I mean, flutes and mellotrons and all of this now, of course, seems passé, but at the time it was quite fresh.
Absolutely.
But really the thing that was most fresh about the group was that it went to the extremes of what was possible, you know. I mean, just as far as you could possibly go, they went. I mean, to playing things deliberately out of tune, you know. I mean, anything that could stretch the realms of possibility as far as it could go, that was the basic basic idea behind it.
When we come back, Greg Lake reveals the tragic story behind the iconic cover art on King Crimson's debut album. For this and your other favorite musician interviews, go to inthestudio.net and download new expanded In the Studio shows for your iPhone or iPad, such as AC/DC. Download them now from the iTunes App Store. I'm Redbeard with Greg Lake in the studio for the King Crimson's In the Court of the Crimson King. King Crimson's original lead singer and bass guitarist Greg Lake died in December 2016. Greg was a great friend of In the Studio.
Hi, this is Greg Lake in the studio for the In the Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson.
Thanks again, Greg. I'm Redbeard here for the Plymouth Rock of Progressive Rock. Yes lead singer John Anderson told me that seeing Kim Crimson at London's Speakeasy Club inspired him and Chris Squire indelibly.
It was a very, very great time in London for experimenting around 68, 69. The five major bands that came out of that time were King Crimson, ELP, Yes, Zeppelin, Deep Purple. These were groups of people that, unbeknown to themselves, were doing very, very similar activity. It was like nobody really knew what each other groups were doing. It just happens that around that period of time, everybody was sort of setting the sort of stall, the sort of theatre for the early 70s kind of music, which in a way came over from England to America. In 68, we were sort of the local band in London that was spoken about very well. And then we went to the Speakeasy one night and we heard this band was playing called King Crimson. And we said, okay, well, let's check them out, see how good they are. And they were great. They seriously were great. And we all sort of, big gloom, you know, we had a big cloud over us for about a week, trying to get over the fact that they were better than us, you know, or more ingenuitive. You know, I mean, they were more, very similar attitude to music, but more organized.
Mike Rutherford of Genesis had a similar reaction to that first King Crimson album.
I do remember that album being actually something that really did impress us, and we felt that where they were going was the way we wanted to sort of go. Obviously, we didn't do quite the same thing, but the area they'd marked out as the territory they're going to work in, I felt was where we were in the same place as well, actually. Then after that, they became something else, but the first album was actually pretty special, I think.
The English music papers raved about King Crimson back then as well. Here's King Crimson singer-bass player back then, Greg Lake.
It became sort of hot on the street, you know. People would... it happened very quickly. I mean, one day we were nothing at all, and the next day people were just killing to see the band, and you would go on the stage and there'd be this phenomenal atmosphere of people just pressed, you know. And the word of mouth, it was a word of mouth thing that happened. And it just did mushroom very, very quickly. I think it was just a bit of a shock at the time in the music business, you know. Maybe the music business at that time was going through a bit of a malaise for one kind of a reason or another. I don't know. I can't really remember. But it did have a shock. It shocked people. Okay. And it was that sort of shocking. But it was also the emotional intensity of the group. It was very emotional. And with the shock value and the emotion, people left, you know, having seen something.
King Crimson employed a rare feature in their creative structure, a non-performing lyricist. It wasn't unprecedented, though, as the Grateful Dead used Robert Hunter, and most famously Elton John collaborated exclusively with lyricist Bernie Taupin. But Greg Lake admits that the words that he sang on In the Court of the Crimson King were not his own.
At that time, Pete was the principal lyricist. Pete Sinfield was the... But, you know, he was taking care of the lyrics at that time. I would, you know, inject ideas into them, and we'd, you know, I'd put in lines and change it. But he was the main lyricist involved in all that. Because he'd been working with Ian McDonald before. That's why people like Elton John and Bernie Taupin have such a long-standing relationship. I mean, it is a touchy thing. But I always have quite a lot of involvement, you know, if it's someone else's song, unless I feel I can interpret it honestly. Pete Sinfield had, and does have, a remarkable talent for lyrics, and he and I have always understood the same language, I suppose, is what you'd say. He always managed to, at that time anyway, he managed to express himself in a way that I could interpret.
Call a moon child dancing in the shallows of a river. Lonely moon child dreaming in the shadows of a willow. Talking
a mountain.
Now, for all of its esteem and place in rock history, it's imperative for you to understand that international rock touring in general was in its infancy in 1969, and King Crimson was pioneering a genre of rock that would peak 3 to 4 years later, with million sellers by Yes, Jethro Tull, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Pink Floyd, and Genesis. But you know what they say about pioneers? They end up being shot down with arrows. Here's Greg Lake with me in the studio.
And we only did the one tour of America. And at the end of that tour, Ian and Mike Giles, I think they really found the travelling a bit arduous. And they just decided to stop touring. They went off and made a solo album. And at that time, I mean, Bob wanted to carry on with the King Crimson thing. And I just didn't feel it was such a substantial part of the band that was departing. I personally didn't feel that it was right to continue on under the same name. And it was at that time that I met Keith in San Francisco, and we decided to embark on the ELP project.
And equally as memorable as the music on that King Crimson debut was the iconic fold-out album cover featuring original painting by Barry Godber. Tragically, it was Godber's first and last painting, according to Greg Lake.
It's a rather sad story that's attached to it. I think it was a friend of Pete Sinfield's, an artist, painter. Young boy, he was about, well, he must have been at the time, same age as us, about 21. And he came along to the studio and heard the music, and we said, look, this is it. You know, it's called Court of the Crimson King, and we want you to do an album cover. So fine. So off he went. A few days later, he came back with this picture. In fact, two pictures. It was the front cover and the back cover, or the inside cover, it's double. And he put it on the floor, and there was this face, you know, and it really was Schizoid Man. It was the picture of the screaming, but it was a fantastic cover, one of the fantastic record covers, I think. It was visionary, and it really did reflect the contents of the album. It really expressed the sounds, the music on the record. A lot of covers that you see are, you know, for one reason or other, marketing tools, or they're this or they're that. And very few of them express what's actually inside the record. That one certainly did. And the very next day, he walked out in the street and dropped dead of a heart attack. Young boy. And when you look at the picture and you think about that, it's a slightly arresting thought, you know, that all this horror and this terror, and the next day he was dead, you know.
Cracking at the seams.
But I feel
King Crimson's original lead singer and bass guitarist Greg Lake died in December 2016. May salvation be his epitaph. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. King Crimson's original lead singer and bass guitarist Greg Lake died in December 2016. May salvation be his epitaph. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking the late, great Greg Lake. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and online at inthestudio.net.